We've all been there, and we've eaten that. And of course, we're talking about we've all eaten at the hands of school lunch ladies. Thinking back at the taste of all those school lunches, we ask, can schools do a better job of feeding our children?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1199th edition of the Food Chain Radio. Or perhaps you're among our friends over there in Yokosuka who are tuned into the podcast on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, having hosted all nearly 1,200 Food Chain Radio shows, I came to the conclusion someplace along the line that three observations always seem to hold true. And so, with literary license in hand, I claim them as Michael Olson's three laws of the food chain. Here, simply stated, is the third law of the food chain. Cheap food isn't. I have observed that food is made cheap by taking the food out of it and by having others subsidize its true cost of production. Thus, the cheap food promised is really the expensive food delivered. I ran across the sentiment expressed in a scholarly tome entitled The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. Here is how the author of Labor of Lunch, Dr. Jennifer Gaddis, expressed that sentiment. For over 70 years, the National School Lunch Program has failed to escape the trap of cheapness. Cheap, in the way I use the term, isn't just a synonym for low cost. Rather, it's a guiding political and economic philosophy, business strategy, and consumer expectation that shapes our everyday lives. One that has had disastrous effects on the healthfulness of school lunches and the wider world. Given the cheap food we feed our school children, we simply must ask, can schools do a better job of feeding our children? To find an answer, we're heading up to Madison, Wisconsin for a conversation with Jennifer Gaddis, who is the Assistant Professor of Civil Society and Community Studies at the University of Wisconsin. And she's the author of course, Labor of Lunch. Welcome to the Food Chain, Dr. Gaddis.
Thank you for having me.
So pleased to be here. So how did a professor of civil society come to focus on school lunch?
That's a great question. So when I originally started the project, I was actually doing my PhD in environmental studies. And I'd gotten very interested in school lunch because I'd heard a lot of people around me being very excited about this concept called farm to school. So this idea of sourcing food locally from local farmers and serving it in school kitchens and cafeterias.
Which would certainly fit right in with environmental studies, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. So I was very interested in this idea of if we have already this huge federal program that we spend almost $14 billion a year on, how can we better use that money to support the kinds of farmers and local food economies that will make sort of environmental implications of food systems better, but also really help rural producers stay on their land. So I was really interested in this to begin with from this environmental perspective. And as I started spending more and more time doing research, I spent more time in the school kitchens and cafeterias themselves. And I started to realize that, you know, a lot of the things that we need to do to improve school lunch really come down to community organizing, to build power, to shift to a different kind of food system. And I think that one of the things that was really transformational for me in terms of kind of moving just from the environmental space to thinking about this really as a community issue was these conversations that I would have with the school lunch workers themselves about how a lot of them really wanted to be serving really nutritious, good-looking, good-tasting meals to the kids that they were feeding. But a lot of them were sort of trapped in these positions where they weren't even cooking food at all. They were just reheating food that they unboxed, out of these brown boxes that are shipped to them from various places. And a lot of them felt like they really didn't have very much control over the food quality that they were serving to the children. And so I started to get really interested in this question of, you know, what's this relationship between the quality of the food that we're serving in schools and the quality of the jobs that workers have in school kitchens, and how can we think about this as a community issue to organize around? Because it's something that impacts not just workers and communities, but also the children and the families that are really dependent on the National School Lunch Program as an important social service.
Well, that's interesting, because you're bringing in what seems to be an entirely new element into the equation of school lunches, which is, of course, we all think about food, but the people who are serving the food as well.
Yeah, and I think if we look at that relationship a little bit more carefully, we'll see that in a lot of schools, they rely on what's called like a heat and serve model of cooking, where instead of cooking from scratch using a lot of basic ingredients like, you know, fresh vegetables, flour, you know, things that are recognizable as kind of single ingredients, what a lot of workers spend time doing is just reheating this industrially made food that oftentimes has a lot more kind of fillers and preservatives and things of that nature that a lot of parents don't necessarily want their kids to be consuming a lot of when they're at schools. But a lot of those ingredients are used precisely because they help, you know, the site of production where we're making food be distanced in both time and space from where we're ultimately consuming food. So in a lot of school kitchens and cafeterias, what ends up happening is there's this real drive to keep labor costs low by purchasing pre-made food. And I think that in the places that I visited, at least in my research, that have the best school lunch programs where they have kind of the highest rates of participation and the food is the most nutritious and tasty and kind of supporting local food and farm economies, the common denominator is that those schools are cooking from scratch. And when schools cook from scratch, there's also these benefits in terms of what it means for the school lunch workers. On the one hand, instead of being in short hour positions, so these 3 or 4 hour positions in the middle of the day where they're hired mainly to reheat food and then serve it to the children, they actually have these longer hour positions because they're needed to do more of that work of actually like, you know, chopping like vegetables and turning them into finished meals. So I think that that component about work is important, not only because a lot of these workers, and there's over 400,000 of them, are predominantly women. Like the labor force is 93% women. So it's definitely something where if we're considering, you know, gender and like justice within the food system, like we have to take seriously, I think, the quality of these jobs from that standpoint. But also from the standpoint that these are a lot of people who are in very, very part-time jobs who want access to more full-time employment. So I think if we keep in mind this idea that we can actually make the food better by investing in the job quality itself, it kind of leads us to a different space to work from.
Well, I guess there's a reason they call them lunch ladies, and if 93% of them were ladies, I guess there it is. You know, some time ago, quite a while ago, I came to the conclusion that the notion that we have cheap food is the big lie. I just don't think food is cheap. Good food is cheap. And you seem to be saying the same thing about school lunches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that that's very true. So there's been historically a tremendous amount of pressure placed on school lunch providers to keep the meal as cheap as possible. And in a lot of ways, we've been sort of taught to think about, like, you know, as taxpayers, we should want this program to be like as efficient as possible. And that often gets boiled down into this, I think, really problematic notion of, well, you know, what is it that we're actually trying to like measure as success? So in the National School Lunch Program, for instance, the federal government counts it as a success based on the number of meals served to children, not on what's actually being consumed. So we sort of conflate this idea of value with the idea of people just being served lunches, even if they're not actually consuming their whole lunches. So There's issues with food waste that have always been a part of the school lunch program. And then I think most sort of notoriously in the 1980s under the Reagan administration, there was a proposal to essentially count ketchup as a vegetable. And part of that was sort of framed under this need to reduce food waste in schools because children were throwing away lots of vegetables. So instead of actually taking a look at, well, why might that be? Like, do the vegetables taste good? Are they prepared in ways that are like, you know, not only tasty, but also culturally appropriate? I think that the impetus is always on, well, we can't make it better, so let's just try to find a way to cheapen it. And I think that a lot of the language around scientific nutrition, where we're measuring like food quality only in terms of like the macro and micronutrients versus kind of a wider range of not only values that people might just attach to food.
Pure simple calories, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, when we think about food only in those terms, we mask over a lot of things that are actually quite important for us to be thinking about. So in the case of the National School Lunch Program, there's this pressure to really keep the food cheap, in part because the federal government for free lunch, the 2019-2020 reimbursement rate is $3.41. It's pretty difficult to, I would say, meet all of the standards nutritionally for the school lunch program without amount of money. A lot of other countries that have school lunch programs, I would say that they invest more like around $5 or so on school lunches if they're really doing things in a way that is leveraging the power of their public school lunch programs to support better forms of agriculture and I would say more fair jobs within the food system. So I think that one of the issues is that the U.S. National School Lunch Program has for a very, very long time been expected to do a lot with a small amount of funding. And as a result, I think a lot of parents whose children don't qualify for free or reduced price lunches, they take a look at what their local cafeterias are serving, and they're not always very impressed by it. And so they don't participate. And so that leads us to the situation where we have about 30 million children who depend on these meals every day, and another 20 million who are opting out and oftentimes bringing lunch from home. And when we have that kind of system, it actually places even more pressure on keeping
because
like,
there's going to be
program.
Less money.
Yeah, exactly. So we can't really have the same kind of economy of scale that you have when you're feeding everyone at once. And I think also it really leads to this situation where there's a lot less political pressure to maintain like the standards of meal quality in terms of, in particular, like the taste and appearance and like, more of the like sort of cultural atmosphere of the cafeteria as being a positive space that children want to spend time in. It's instead treated much more as a poverty program. And I think that
well, you know,
there's
that's
a real issue with that.
Yeah, that's a good place to pick up when we come back from this break. But I guess the real essential question of all school lunch programs is how can you serve broccoli to children and get them to eat it? Now, that is a problem that I've never seen anybody being able to overcome, but maybe Dr. Jennifer Gaddis has seen that, and we'll figure it out when we come back. But when we come back, I'd like to go to the radical roots of the school lunch program, a national program. We spend $14 billion a year, and if as long as we're spending all that money, is there a way to make that investment in our school kids more efficient and above all, more tasty so the kids eat the stuff? This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What? Today, School Lunch with Jennifer Gaddis, the author of The Labor of Lunch. It's not just the food, it's the people. Right back. Stay tuned. Okay, we're looking for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for this hour. Today we're talking about school lunches. Oh my goodness, when's the last time you had a school lunch and really enjoyed it? Do you remember your school lunch? I bet you do. I bet you remember chocolate milk. That's what I remember it anyway. And that's been a while ago, but I still remember them. And I still remember the food fights we had as kids. and all of those fun things. But the question is, how can we make the $14 billion per year investment we have in our kids more efficient, better? So the kids eat it, so the workers enjoy serving it, so that it becomes a bigger and more significant part of everybody's lives. $14 billion a year. When did we start this National School Lunch Program, Dr. Gaddis?
So it was actually founded in 1946. But I think it's really important for us to recognize that even though most people will say the National School Lunch Program started in 1946 and kind of leave it at that, that there was actually 50 years of work that went into creating that. 50 years of work? So as someone who studies communities and is interested in community organizing, I always like to sort of tell the story that school lunch actually started in the 1890s. And it's really something that if we look at it through this lens of caring for children and caring for them, not only in homes, but also in schools, we can sort of start to see all of this history of organizing to create the very first school lunch programs as something that actually was quite radical and in many ways a feminist project.
Now, you call that period of time that the progressive era. And mm-hmm. I'm not sure I've ever heard that. But what was the progressive era?
Yeah, so the progressive era, most historians will sort of say that it's between the 1890s through the 1920s. And this was really a time period in which a lot of the kinds of social programs and the labor protections that now many of us kind of take for granted were initially debated, and many of which were really institutionalized during this time period. So there was a lot of labor union activism. There was a lot of expansion of different kinds of social services, public schooling being one of them. So I think that the progressive era is really sort of best thought of as this time in which there was this real expansion of the rights of, I would say, children mm-hmm. to get an education and workers to really have a little bit more of a voice in their workplaces.
Sure. And then into this era steps Emma Smedley.
Yeah. So she is actually a home economist, and many of the people who are really active in this movement to create nonprofit school lunch programs were trained as home economists. So they were some of the first women to really graduate with university degrees and to think very proactively about how they could create new professions for themselves to use those skills in ways that would benefit a broader society.
You mentioned nonprofit school lunch programs.
Mm-hmm.
So was this a conscious effort way back then to set up nonprofit school lunch program?
It was, yes. So I would say that even like today, how some schools will participate in the National School Lunch Program, which is not-for-profit, and other schools may choose to run their own school lunch program. Oftentimes, those are still not-for-profit. But back in the day, so in the 1890s, there was also competition in schools. So a lot of the times what kids would do if they weren't bringing a lunchbox from home is they would purchase something that was for sale either like from a street cart, so things like pretzels and pickles and pies, so kind of like the what people maybe would have considered to be not so nutritious food of the time, so like salty, starchy, sweet mm-hmm. kind of foods or things.
All of those things that taste really good but are not good for you, right?
Exactly. So all these things, there were, I think, concerns that kids were not only using their money to buy like not so nutritious food from vendors and sometimes from janitors who would set up shops often with their wives, like as kind of for-profit concessionaires inside school buildings. There were these concerns that children were getting food from them that wasn't particularly nutritious, but that also maybe wasn't always sanitary. So these women reformers were really concerned about a few different things at once. So on the one hand, they were concerned about the nutritious quality of the food, but they were also concerned about whether or not it was actually being produced under proper like food safety kind of conditions. Mm-hmm. And then the third piece to it was they were really concerned about children who couldn't afford to purchase food. So a big component of these early school lunch programs was really about charitable efforts to help the poor. Okay. So a lot of the early efforts were really about fundraising for how they could actually generate enough money to provide free meals to very poor children. But then I think that there were also these concerns about, even for middle-class women, like it not being particularly easy to pack a balanced school lunch every day, especially with the kinds of, they didn't have the little, bento boxes or plastic.
You know what it gets right down to? It's probably still difficult. To pack a balanced lunch or a balanced meal for a kid. I know I find it difficult for myself, to pack a balanced meal. And so it's still difficult.
I think that that's a really great point. And one thing that I would emphasize about that is particularly when it comes to packing children's meals, that's something that is still today very, very gendered. So even though, multiple parents might be kind of taking on domestic responsibilities, if we look at the data in the U.S., the majority of food work and of work that's, being done to care for children is still being done by women. So I think we have to kind of keep that piece in mind, that this is not work that sort of everyone does equally, right? This is
right.
Work that is really feminized to a very large extent.
Right. And the tradition of moms, I guess, in that tradition. You talk about, and with respect to care for children, you talk about the new economy of care being from this progressive era. What mean you by that?
Yeah, so I talk about how in this progressive era, a lot of these women were really interested in creating a new economy of care. And by that I mean they really wanted to sort of have the state, so whether it be at the local level, the level of the state, or the federal government, take a larger role in providing public forms of care. So on the one hand, that might be something like a school lunch program, might also be something like public bathhouses or things like public libraries, so all these things that are kind of necessary for people to take care of themselves and to live good lives. They were really interested in thinking about the kind of relative roles of the individual and society and providing for the caring needs of everyone. Mm-hmm. And I think that their big move when it comes to the school lunch program was to sort of recognize that a lot of the private struggles that individual women were facing in their households related to, packing nutritious school lunches and making sure that food was safe, because we kind of have to keep in mind as well that this was right around, it was 1908 when the first, Pure Food and Drug Law was passed in the U.S., so the first major piece of food safety legislation. So for some of the early years in which these conversations were happening, a lot of these women were really concerned about not only not really knowing what was in food, because they felt like they couldn't always trust producers to be honest and ethical mm-hmm. about what they were manufacturing, but there were also these concerns about, I would say, a lot of the things that modern day parents struggle with, how to actually find information, how to make sure that the information that you're getting is a trustworthy source. So instead of having to kind of individually be sussing through all this information and making decisions, they were really interested in trying to say, okay, well, we want to organize new ways for our children to be cared for. So maybe we can actually, create a program where people at school are fed together, and then we can use our resources as parents and as community members to hire someone who's trained in home economics, who understands dietetics, who understands more of these intricacies of the food system, and they can really be the ones who are organizing some sort of efficient program for feeding our kids. So I think in this kind of new economics of care, one of the things that they are really trying to do is to sort of say, we aren't going to view this only as an individual responsibility. We're going to think about how we can come together to create new ways of caring for each other.
Which is a huge existential leap in way of thinking, because these were rugged times and rugged individualist people, and now they're coming to grips with, maybe we should band together and rope in the government on this. You know, you also talk about a different kind of care, too. You talk about bringing care to the forefront as being a way, during this progressive era, of bringing care, the whole notion of how we care for children, instead of just warehousing them, you actually start bringing the notion of food service workers as caring for children. Do you expand on that?
Sure. I think that one of the things that is really important to recognize is that, especially for food service workers who are serving food or at the cashier station, they're having a lot of interaction for every day with the children that they're feeding. And many of them get to know the kids that they're feeding, like their names, their likes, their dislikes. If they're in a particular school or particular neighborhood for a long period of time, they might even know like that child's siblings or even their parents. They may have fed, multiple generations of the same family. And so I think for a lot of the workers, being able to express care for the children through these everyday interactions as the child is coming through the lunch line, that's an important part of their jobs. And sometimes it can be challenging, particularly if they are being asked to do a lot of work in a very short period of time. So something as simple as like smiling at the children and, having kind of a positive affect can be another way of expressing care. I think another component of it is them really caring about the quality of the food and the quality of the conditions in the cafeteria. So some of the workers that I interviewed for the book were actually involved in like multi-year campaigns, particularly in districts that have a unionized labor force, to really use worker power to push for things that will actually make conditions better for the children that they're feeding. So I think this component about food service workers really caring about children is a really important but often overlooked part of the conversation about what is necessary for school lunch reform, but also kind of where a source of power could come from. And I think in the early days of school lunch programs, a lot of the same kinds of goals that we have today in terms of helping children understand like where their food is coming from, making sure they're eating nutritious food, those are all things that frontline food service workers and the people who were kind of designing these programs were concerned about then, and I think we're still concerned about today. So that care component, I think, has always really been there.
And then in 1946, we passed a law, the National School Lunch Program, and we're off to the races. And part of that program mandated that local food systems were adopted in the school lunch program, which is to say they couldn't hire outside contractors to feed the school kids. Now, that changed in the 1970s, and away we go, right?
It did, yes. So one of the things that I think was a major win when the 1946 School Lunch Act was passed was they did say, okay, to all of you like home economists and other women who have been involved in these programs for years, we hear you. We understand you want to have a nonprofit school lunch program, and we understand that you want to sort of protect it from what might be a little bit of a corroding force if some of these corporations are allowed to set up shop in school lunchrooms. So for the first several decades of the National School Lunch Program, schools were not allowed to contract with these for-profit providers like Aramark, Sodexo, Chartwells. Those are some of the big names that people might hear about today. So it wasn't until the very early 1970s that change was passed. And so the National Restaurant Association, which is a very sort of large like lobbying force for the food service industry, was very instrumental in getting that law changed. And they were very effective at using a crisis within the National School Lunch Program to sort of convince federal policymakers that the kind of expertise that the food industry has was the kind of expertise that was necessary to really bring the National School Lunch Program to the next level.
And so the next level proved to be what?
Yeah, so the big issue there was that a lot of schools had been built without kitchen or cafeteria facilities, particularly in urban areas. So a lot of the suburban kids, like from white middle-class families, throughout much of the 1950s, 1960s, they were able to access the benefits of the National School Lunch Program, whereas there were tons and tons, like millions of poor kids, mainly from urban areas and rural areas, who were systematically excluded from the National School Lunch Program simply because their schools didn't have the facilities to participate. So in the late 1960s, there was this real effort to uncover what really was, I think, structural racism that was embedded within the National School Lunch Program. And a lot of these activists, some from the civil rights movement, some from a variety of different women's groups, and some from the anti-hunger movement, sort of all came together and were able to push the government to expand access to free school lunches. But the problem was that they really wanted this to be done very quickly, and it takes a while to raise money and actually build facilities for kitchens and cafeterias. So the food industry really used this moment of crisis to say, hey, don't worry, we know how to feed children in really small spaces. Like, we perfected this, you know, in the airlines.
Sure. So,
like,
and
let
it
us
always,
come do that.
It always seems to take a crisis, doesn't it? And once you get a crisis, you can go to Washington, D.C. and spread some money around and get a real good solution real fast. And that's really how the school lunch program was transformed. Right back. Stay tuned. Well, we are back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What? With the Labor of Lunch, an examination of the school lunch program, a reimagining of the school lunch program. Would it be possible to take the $14 billion a year we're spending on school lunches and make some good lunches, improve the productivity, improve the nutrition, improve the delivery? Would it be possible? Well, gosh, Jennifer, would it?
I think so. So I spent about 5 years traveling around to school districts that are already doing that. So I feel like most of the time when I have conversations with people about school lunch, I get exactly the question that you just posed, like, is this possible? So that was one of the reasons why in the book I made this decision to not just go to kind of any old school district that's got a run-of-the-mill school lunch program, but to really go to some places that are showing us what's possible, because I think sometimes once we see things in action, it's a little bit easier to believe.
Sure. There's a question. Can anybody actually do this? Is somebody doing it? What are they doing?
Yeah.
Well, backing up just a little bit, though, you know, we have essentially a system in which we sort children by income. Correct?
And yeah.
In the school lunch, making it kind of embarrassing for some kids that can't afford to eat what other kids get to eat. And then we do things like lunch shaming. What's that?
So lunch shaming is something that I think has gotten increasing attention in the last 3 or 4 years. And it basically stems from something called lunch debt. So basically, if a kid doesn't qualify for a free lunch, they either qualify for a reduced price or a full price lunch. And if they don't pay for their reduced price lunch, which is 40 cents for the lunch, or whatever price the school is charging for the full price lunch, what ends up happening is they accrue debt. And if that debt exceeds a certain amount that the district has set, then usually there's some sort of policy put in place where the workers are instructed to, oftentimes it's provide a substitute meal, so something like a cold cheese sandwich. Other times it might be to take the tray of food away from the child, even if it's already been served, and to dump it into the trash. So those two things, serving the cold cheese sandwich is sort of a mark of stigma. So is sure. having your, you know, your plate trashed in front of like all your peers. So those are examples of what people refer to as lunch shaming.
Yeah.
And most school districts will try to send like a letter home to parents or to work with them to resolve the debt before they resort to those policies. But, you know, it's hard for families to make ends meet, particularly like right at that threshold of qualification for free or reduced price lunches.
You know, there's been a lot of effort to redo school lunches led by people like Alice Waters and Michelle Obama. What has happened to those efforts?
Yeah, I think that both are really great examples. So Michelle Obama, I think, brought a lot of attention to school lunches in general. And the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act of 2010, which is the major piece of legislation that she was really involved with championing, it has been really successful in bringing more salad bars, more fresh fruits and vegetables, and more whole grains into schools. But there have been some issues with some rollbacks of those regulations, first under the Obama administration and then later under the Trump administration, that sort of weakened the nutrition standards to allow for more starchy vegetables or fine grains, salt, and higher fat content in flavored milks. So those are all things that in a lot of ways are really sort of giveaways to the various food industry lobbyists who ask
sure.
for those things to be changed.
Well, wasn't it also lobbying by the children themselves who were not eating, you know, the healthy food?
It's interesting that you say that because there were definitely like some pretty prominent social media campaigns of like hashtag thanks Michelle Obama with pictures of children's plates. And I think that there were a lot of stories of increased food waste. But the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which is the federal agency that oversees all of the child nutrition programs, including the National School Lunch Program, they released a study in May 2019 that really showed that the amount of food waste in schools hasn't changed since the new regulations went into effect, and the overall nutritional quality of school lunches actually increased by 41% between the 2009-2010 school year and the 2014-2015 school year. So what that really tells us is that the food, at least from a nutritional perspective, has actually gotten quite a bit better, and food waste has stayed the same. So I think a lot of those concerns about sort of children voting with their forks and, you know, throwing stuff into the trash were a little bit overblown for some like partisan political reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we still have to ask ourselves, you know, why, even if the food is more nutritious, are kids throwing away so much of the food? To go back to your earlier point about what does it take to get kids to actually eat broccoli?
There you go. The question of the year. Well, with respect to transforming our school lunches, you write, we will need to cultivate a transformative school lunch politics that is responsive to escalating concerns about climate change, environmental justice, and racial justice. We will need to make new connections between school lunch and feminist food politics while tapping into the growing strength of the food justice movement and the emergence of a new generation of worker-led campaigns for economic justice. This is a lot of work, Dr. Gaddis. My goodness, where do we start?
It is a lot of work. And I think to get to your point earlier about, for instance, the work of Alice Waters, I think that she's been someone who's been really successful in getting people to think about at least the school garden component of this and how connecting kids
to
nature
their food
in that way can be really helpful in terms of getting us to make some of these connections between the school lunch program and environmental concerns. There's been a number of reports that have come out lately that have talked about, you know, the impact of the industrial agricultural system with respect to climate change. So I think that one of the things that's really important is to help people start to understand that the National School Lunch Program is one of the kind of main sources of funding that we have to play with. And I think that it's really interesting to think about it as something that exists in pretty much every neighborhood, like every community that you can think of across the rural to urban divide. And it's something that not only touches the production side of agriculture, so we could, for instance, be using more of those public dollars to support local farmers who use more sustainable farming techniques. We currently don't do that at the national level. There is some grant funding for farm-to-school programs, and schools are allowed to do this kind of values-based purchasing, but it's not really mandated by any stretch of the imagination. So there's this, I think, real opportunity to not only be thinking about the climate and environmental aspects of the food sourcing and supply, but also to think about, for instance, if we were to move to a universal free model of school lunches, which is something that an increasing number of school districts are doing at the local level.
Yeah, Atlanta, the city of Atlanta.
Yeah, exactly. So just this last, I think, week that they had announced that. So I think we're seeing kind of movement in the right direction with the universal free school lunch component. And I think that that's something that really helps when we're starting to look more at the racial justice side of things, because to kind of go back to that earlier point about how 30 million children participate and 20 million don't. Well, it's disproportionately children from communities of color that are participating in the National School Lunch Program. And I think that, you know, all of those kids deserve to have a really high quality meal as well, and to be able to participate with their families and really making sure that school lunches reflect the values and the cultures of American society as it exists today.
Well, may I ask you a really embarrassing question, which is, where are the parents in this, in all of this equation of school lunches? Where are the parents? What responsibilities do parents have? Parents have for tending their children.
That's a really good question. I think that you know, parents have different opinions on this. I think some parents are so busy, like so stretched between multiple low wage jobs, that I think they're, you know, relatively happy that the school lunch program exists. It may not be everything they want it to be, but certainly their children are going to participate. I think other parents take a look at the school lunch program and aren't very happy with how it looks. And so instead of investing in this project of really trying to change what the school lunch program looks like at their school, oftentimes they just opt for the individual solution.
So that's the $20 million, right?
Yeah, so of like purchasing what they consider to be higher quality food for their kids. And so I think that for a lot of parents, it's a challenge to think about, well, how do we move from, you know, just getting by day to day and maybe making things a little bit better for our own children, to this sort of broader question of, well, how do we actually invest in making the whole program high enough quality to where everyone would be really excited for their children to participate in the lunch program? And I'll just mention that I actually did about a month of field work in Japan this summer on their school lunch program, and they're really sort of recognized as a global expert in terms of providing really nutritious school lunch program that also has like really wonderful food education built into it. And I did some interviews with parents there. And one of the things that I thought was so interesting is that they really talked about how in Japan, where school lunch is universal, where all children participate, they really appreciated that the school becomes this place where they can have a lot of things like very traditional dishes that are a little bit more time consuming to prepare in a common environment. And they can sort of, you know, learn about nutritional aspects, also learn about like the
go to school where they can go to school and learn things, right?
Yeah, like, and a lot of this things related to, you know, what we would hope children would learn related to the producers of their food, maybe related to things that are grown locally that are unique to like that particular region. All of those things are sort of embedded into the educational structure of school lunch. And so parents, I think, are really grateful that that's something that the sort of local school board does for them, right? So they're still feeding their kids in the evening. They're still like feeding their kids in the morning, you know, during vacations and things of that nature. But they really appreciate that, you know, during this time.
Well, I'm sure every parent appreciates that for sure. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, help. Now, I see two principal obstacles to transformative change. Maybe you can address them for me. Mm-hmm. The first would be entropy, which is, of course, you have all of this volition, this powerful movement to make change. The change is made, and then it kind of runs down and disappears, kind of like you saw in the 1890s, the progressive era, a bunch of women got together and fought for 50 years for a national school lunch program, and they got it, and then it kind of run down to being not a very good place for feeding children. The other obstacle to transformative change are the vested interests in not changing, because the interests are making a lot of money, and they can go to Washington, D.C., or wherever the power is, and invest in keeping things the same, which is to say they can donate liberally to the politicians, and there you are. Both of those things seem to have happened to the school lunch, to the national school lunch program. Am I wrong?
I think you're 100% correct on that.
How do we overcome those?
Yeah, I think that that's where your earlier question about, you know, where are there good things happening, I think becomes especially instructive. So when we have these examples of what things look like and, you know, what is successful at the local level and even the state level, I think that that gives us something to point to and to really build from. So as an example, Minneapolis Public Schools is one of the districts that I end up profiling in one of the chapters of the book. And I think what impressed me so much about their example is in a pretty short time span of just about 7 years, they went from serving these little prepack lunches that look kind of like a TV dinner,
sure,
that were produced in a central kitchen that was built in the 1970s and in operation up until, you know, the 2010s. Lunches kind of all looking the same, rolling off these little assembly lines and being trucked to the schools. They switched from that model to a model of really becoming a national leader in the farm-to-school movement and sort of this broader movement for real food in schools. And they did that by investing in building kitchens at the schools themselves and in retraining workers and creating new positions that are really designed to be, you know, facilitating cooking from scratch in schools versus just reheating from food. And in doing that, they've been able to increase the quality of the food and raise the participation rate, particularly among those kids who don't qualify for free or reduced price lunches. And they've been able to, I think, become really one of the national leaders in the farm to school movement. So instead of just having a locally sourced apple be something that is like a special occasion, they're actually directing very significant portions of their school lunch dollars to local producers. And as they've developed this capacity to cook school lunches from scratch, they've been able to be much more discerning about, you know, what kind of ingredients are we going to
allow. Well, let me ask you this, Jennifer. Let me ask you this. Can they get kids to eat broccoli?
Yeah, and that I think is where we can't think about school lunch as being something that's distinct from education.
We're out of time, Jennifer, but thank you so much for joining us on the Food Chain Radio program.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.